Welcome to Valhalla Conversations Podcast. I'm your host, Becky Hill, otherwise known as Soul Chaser Becky, and I am a proud Viking geek. I fell in love with the history, culture, and mythology of the Viking Age, and I have been on an endless quest for more ever since. Join me as I discuss all things Norse with those who have been inspired by Viking Age history and Norse mythology in their creative works, or those who have studied the sagas and archaeology, and review how such subjects are being presented to modern audiences today. If you like Viking stuff, you are welcome in my Valhalla, and I hope you stay for the conversation. Welcome everyone to the Valhalla Conversation Podcast, episode 16. And this month, I'm delighted to welcome a previous guest to the podcast. She joined us on our big panel where we reviewed the Ragnarok Netflix TV series. But I'm delighted to welcome back author Genevieve Cornishek. Welcome, Genevieve.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me back. The Ragnarok episode, it was so much fun. So I highly recommend anybody who hasn't watched or listened to that episode to go back and do it, because it was a great episode and a great show.
Oh yes, absolutely. I second and third and fourth that. Absolutely. Because it was wonderful, and of course it was the first time we had you on. I've got to talk to you more personally, and that was just before your second book came out, which was The Weaver and the Witch Queen, if I'm not turning it into my virtual background. There it is in all its beautiful glory. I will have it popping up on the screen more graphically.
It belongs in a Viking hall.
But before that one, you also wrote The Witch's Heart. So I guess we'll start off with the first book first, because that makes sense. Now, to give a kind of a brief insight for readers, it follows your retelling of a character often overlooked and often forgotten in Norse mythology. Although it's kind of interesting blend of two characters, some would say, which is Angriboda, which was a giantess that Loki had an affair with and had his monstrous children with, of Hel, Fenrir and Jormungand, but also of an even older female character from the pantheon called Gullveig, otherwise known as the Golden Shining One. So I guess, where did you begin when you first decided to tell the story of these two characters?
So it was actually during a Norse mythology course at my university. I remember, like, very distinctly my professor saying something during one of our classes. Wouldn't it be fascinating if there was one big scary lady lurking behind all of the other big scary ladies in this mythology? And, like, you know, my brain just, like, turned on. I was like, ooh, wouldn't that be great? And wouldn't that be a great novel? And I ended up writing my term paper on this exact topic, like trying to connect Angriboda to, like, these other mysterious female figures. But I really couldn't have taken that past, like, a term paper, right? Like, there's not a ton of evidence. It's just kind of a cool what if, you know? But it would make a good book, right? So at the same time I was writing that term paper in November of 2011, I decided to do this silly little thing called NaNoWriMo. Which, to anybody who doesn't know, it's a writing challenge of sorts where writers from all around the world decide that we hate ourselves enough to try to write 50,000 words during the month of November. So I finished the first draft of The Witch's Heart in 3 weeks in November of 2011. Wow.
Gosh, yep. I salute you.
Thank you. Thanks.
So what made you decide to pick the two characters of Angriboda and Gullveig and almost blend them into one identity? Because that's what emerges for those who read the book, and that's not explaining it too much, in that right. She has one, you meet her in one identity, and then you discover that actually she's got this older identity that even she is almost forgotten about.
Right. So that also stems back from that day in class, because we were talking about all of the different female figures in Norse mythology who we sort of don't know anything about, but they have, like, these little attributes in common, right? So I ended up combining Angriboda with, like, a total of, like, four different figures. But, like, you're right, Gullveig is the big one that I've combined her with. Mm-hmm. And granted, like, there's Sorry about the jingling in the background if you could hear it. That is my cats. There's a lot more evidence to suggest that Freya was Gulveig and not Angerboda, but again, it was a cool kind of like what if, right? So I just kind of went with it because I thought it would make a great story.
Interesting. That is really interesting. I have read in the multiple nonfiction books I have read on the mythology that kind of like Freya has been associated with Gulveig because, of course, her ability with cedar magic, and I really quite like that relationship that you explore, that or that connection, although there is a definite relationship of sorts.
Yes. Not
an amicable one. But there's a complex relationship between these two female figures and their power. Because yes. Of course they all seem to eventually get drawn towards Odin, because of course Odin is the power-hungry god. Not that many people in modern society recognize him as such, but he just wants to know everything, wants to know everything, wants to be able to do everything, including what the women do. Because cedar magic, as we both know, is a feminine art form of talent and quality and prophecy and that kind of thing. So how much research did you go into? Did you go into a big deep dive into either of these characters, or did you just kind of skim the surface and then take bits?
It was really based like on the Eddas. I purposely avoided reading any sort of fiction about Norse mythology or any sort of retellings besides Kevin Crossley Holland's retelling, which remains my favorite. And I just didn't want to be influenced by anybody else's ideas because, and you probably are very familiar with this, but there's a lot of Norse inspired novels out there, including my own, that do take some liberties. And I didn't want to like accidentally, you know, kind of like absorb somebody else's idea and use it in my own stuff, because I wanted to be able to trace everything that I was doing back to the Eddas and say, here is why I made this decision. Here's why I made that decision. My research basically was kind of the Eddas. And then once the Witch's Heart sold to Penguin Random House in the US and Titan Books in the UK, and it was, about to be published, and I had to revise, that's when I kind of did like a deeper dive, like looking up like different scholarly articles, rereading the Eddas, and really just trying to like get my ducks in a row. Some of the ducks would not stay in the row, but it's no easy task revising something that you wrote 10 years prior.
Well, it's come out as a really, truly wonderful book. And I think it's brilliant that it started off with that what if moment, because I think that's the only way we can really get deeper into these characters and their origins. Because as you say, there's little bits of them. We don't have the full picture by any means. And it's one thing I keep coming across again and again in my research, especially with female figures from the pantheon, both as the goddesses, but of course the giantesses like Angerboda, the great Volva of all, which is called like Hade, even kind of like the prophetess, the Volva that tells Odin about how everything's going to end in fire and doom and Ragnarok and things. Like, we don't know how she became who she was, but we've got her backstory. Whereas all the male gods just have like all these like great adventures. It's like there's not much for the women.
Right. I think I actually combined Angerboda with six characters, now that you mention it. Like the, because I wasn't counting the Seeress from the Seeress prophecy.
Yes, you're right, now I remember it.
And the Seeress from Baldur's Dreams. So I combined her with Gulveig, Hade, Hyrokin, Hidla, and the Seeress and the other Seeress. So yes, combined her with six. So she's seven women in one. But if my argument at the time was, you know, Odin has all these different names, why can't a woman have all these different names?
That is a really, really good point. That is a very good point. And it's certainly not one, it's certainly not an argument I've come across before. And I thought this is why I find not just the retellings that you and many other authors do, both kind of like in nonfiction, as in kind of like purposefully retranslating the Eddas or exploring them in fiction universes, which are outside of the Eddas, but kind of exploring your thought process and how you got to that idea in the first place.
Yeah.
Because it just shows what we're lacking. But also, I think I've said this in several episodes now, it's kind of like the boon and the curse of Norse mythology, and that the fact that we have these puzzle pieces missing, it means that we can play with them very figuratively and literally by inserting, well, it could be this or it could be that, because there isn't anyone around today. Of course, there's no definitive book saying, nope, this did not happen. It was so-and-so who did this and it was so-and-so who did that. Whereas it is like that with a lot of mythologies and pantheons to do with other belief systems or just general folklore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So yeah, it's fascinating.
It is, and that's kind of why I was as straightforward as I possibly could be in the appendix of The Witch's Heart when I'm talking about all the different figures, because that is like the objectively what the Eddas say. Like, that is, you know, not something I made up. That's what we have of these people. Because I, you know, the last thing I want to do is like try to rewrite the canon, right? Because the Witch's Heart literally was meant as a what if. It's not supposed to be like, actually, Norse mythology was really this way. It's just like, here is one of the ways that the Norse mythology could be. Because I'm sorry if you've heard me say this before, I've said it a million times, but like, if you gave 1,000 different writers the task of writing Angerboda's story, you're going to get 1,000 different stories. And mine is just one of them.
No, you haven't said that before, and that's entirely true. And that is really quite what sums up the whole subgenre of Norse fantasy. They're all retellings, unique. I've never come across any one story that is even close to the next one. Even there's loads of stories about there about Loki, of course, being the new anti-hero of the 21st century.
Absolutely.
But they're all distinctly different. They may all be charming and witty, but every Loki has subtle undertones of something else that make him stink, not just in like his the aesthetics, but just his actual personality. And
absolutely,
that's the wonder of the imagination. It's just a huge mirror that can reflect so many different ideas around.
And it's so fascinating to me that so many, you know, authors have these different takes on figures like Loki, but there are those common threads where you do recognize this character, even though the author has put their own spin on it. And sometimes their interpretation doesn't vibe, and that's okay. I'm sure that there's plenty of people who've picked up my books and got, you know, a few pages in and was like, this is not for me. This is not my Loki. This is not my Norse mythology. And that's okay. I've done the same thing with other people's books. So it's every single person is going to have their own unique take on these things. And that's what's really cool about writing in this genre.
I think because there's an episode that will have dropped already when this episode drops on my channel, where I spoke to a wonderful storyteller called, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've forgotten his name. I apologize. I'm going to say it's not Jacob. Jason Book. Apologies, Jason. I will remember your name. I knew it began with a J. That's so close. Okay, but kind of like, because he himself doesn't quite do retellings, he almost takes elements and aspects of Norse folklore and sometimes a bit of the mythology and makes his own original stories. And he told a wonderful one that was a sort of about kind of like a warrior hero going off against the odds. It was a female warrior going off against the odds. And instead of having an element of Odin or Loki getting involved, there was an element of Freya getting involved. And that just, oh, it was amazing.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to check this out.
He's told the whole story on his YouTube channel. I will put the links below and I will email them to you before this one goes out. It's in 2 parts. But yeah, it was really wonderfully told. And I thought that's just so inspired to hear anyone tell a new story about Freya. But that felt so fitting and
fantastic.
Yeah, what I was trying to say originally was when I was speaking to about Jason about this, was that we both agreed that kind of because of these gaps that we can fill with our own imagination and interpretation and creativity, it helps the pantheon and the characters always reflect what issues or what's going on in our society now. Our modern mentality today, it's why it's existed for so many centuries. It's not become dated, it's not become old, it's not become fixed in such as old days way, like kind of the Victorians or the Shakespeare age has.
Absolutely.
It's just always moved on, even though it's not quite an era like the Victorians and Shakespeare, but that's another way of describing it, I suppose.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
So Loki does, of course, feature in The Witch's Heart because he does have a relationship with Angerboda. But I really quite liked the way you explored, if not enlightened for me at least, his connection with the aspect of Gulveig Heid and finding her heart, the witch's heart, because it was an aspect of that character and her story that I'd never actually come across before. So only kind of like when I did later, we were like, oh yeah, he does actually mention he finds a heart. I'm like, oh, that's actually, it's such a strange narrative element to have existed for so long, just out on its own with no wider context. And so I really liked how you explored that in this narrative as well.
Thank you.
So was Witch's Heart your first book? I'm guessing so.
It was not the first book that I wrote. It was the third book that I, third or fourth, third. I think it was the third book that I ever wrote. When I was in high school and my first few years at university, I was working on a vampire series. We're talking, this was like 2008 to 2011. Okay. No, I started that in 2006. So it was the heyday of vampires, right? One of the, hopefully they're coming back. But one of the big eras of like vampire fiction. So I was working on this vampire series. And then I kind of stopped to write The Witch's Heart in the middle of that. I was so productive as an undergrad. Like, I wish I could have the same like production level as I did in my early 20s. But yeah, so I wrote those two books, then I wrote The Witch's Heart. And then I wrote two more books of another series. That's kind of like an urban fantasy, but Valkyries. I don't know if it's ever going to see the light of day, but it was a ton of fun. And I might go back and work on that one day.
Genevieve, I would buy them. Anything with Valkyries gets my money because that's my catnip.
Thank you. They were very, very, very silly. And they were both also NaNoWriMo novels in 2013 and 2015. I wrote those. I have NaNoWriMo is like a hit or miss with me. Like every other year I tend to finish it. But yes, so I wrote those two. And when I was trying to get an agent, a literary agent, those were the first things I tried when I was querying. The vampire series, no go. And then the Valkyrie series, no go. And I was like, okay, you know what? I've got The Witch's Heart in my back pocket. It's technically part of the vampire series, but I revised it to be a standalone for publication, which is why, you know, it was like 7 years before I tried to even publish The Witch's Heart. I just kind of sat on it for that time. So yeah.
And how did you find the whole process of seeking publication?
It was difficult.
Quite a hard one.
Yeah, it took I started in 2013 trying to get published with the Valkyrie, well, with the vampire book, and then I wrote the Valkyrie book. But 2013 to 2018, I was sending out, you know, dozens of emails trying to get an agent. And it wasn't until 2018 that I started even querying The Witch's Heart. Because until then I was like, well, you know, who's going to read a book like this, where it's just this witch who's sitting in the middle of the woods doing her own thing, hiding from the gods, whatever. And then That's In Your Circe by Madeline Miller came out. I was like, okay, so maybe there is a market for this type of thing. So, but you know, 5 years of trying before I finally got anywhere. So it was tough.
So how proud were you when The Witch's Heart finally became this beautiful edition that it is?
I was pretty proud. I was pretty proud, but it was, you know, I was also pretty, pretty young when I wrote it. So like the first half of the book has stayed pretty much the same since 2011, whereas the second half has undergone major revisions.
So The Witch's Heart got published, and then how was it for you kind of like promoting it, meeting readers, getting it into bookshops, seeing it go on sale online? Because I know I remember messaging you on social media saying I had placed it on order in the UK and then it fell through. But I went to Amazon and then it kind of finally got started.
That was wild. It was interesting debuting during we were still in lockdown. It came out in the US it was February of 21, and then it came out in the UK in May of 21. So a lot of my stuff was virtual. Like my launch party was virtual. All my talks were virtual. I did a bunch of podcasts recordings because virtual. And it was so much different than the Weaver and the Witch Queen promotion. But it was a lot of fun. It was so much fun to see how many people were touched by this story that I had kept to myself at that point for 10 years. I'm still like overwhelmed by the reception to this book. Like I never would have guessed that this book that I wrote at university would have you know, so many people who love it. I feel very fortunate and grateful.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased it has pulled off here, because I personally went through English studies with creative writing, having the same dream of getting a book published through my university or after university. But procrastination is my greatest nemesis. And yes, without someone giving me deadlines, same. I will just say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow. Huh? Oh, look, uh-huh. I'll finish this book. I'll just finish this chapter up here. Oh, mm-hmm. I'll read a comic up here. And then eventually I just thought, you know what? I just can't. I lost any connection I had with the writing that I did during that time. And a lot of it was North Space, nearly all my poems.
Oh, wow.
I had poetry, which was terrible poetry, because I forced rhyme because I can't not rhyme.
Yeah.
A lot of that was North Space. There was one short story I did in my first year, which was about a Valkyrie, and that eventually halted as an attempt to do a Valkyrie novel. She got as far as Scarborough geographically in the book, and then I stopped because I was like, I don't know how to make you fly. I don't know how to do it. So I sympathize and empathize a lot with the struggles you face, but I also am really salute you for the effort that you did, the passion that you kept with, especially National Novel Writing Month. It wasn't around when I was doing my degree. Plus, I don't know if I would have actually had the patience or stamina to do it, because life, video games, films, it was just...
Having a kiddo.
Oh, yes. That definitely came along. Strangely enough, my passions have just morphed into other things, because after kind of like, I've always been a reader, hence why we're talking about your wonderful books. Reading has kept maintained constantly. But I went from writing creatively, then into cosplay, and then I'm now doing podcasting. So here we are.
Awesome. That's great.
And all points I've tried to do something Norse, apart from in the cosplay. I couldn't quite find the costume to do that was suitable for a beginner.
Viking reenactment.
It's basically Viking cosplay.
Well, we will get onto that, on that topic, because I know from your social media activity and, of course, on your website and newsletters that you do go to Viking festivals. So please tell us about how you got into all that, because you do go in the full costume and gear, do you not?
Yes. So I started doing Viking reenactment in 2014. I was at my local medieval and Renaissance fair. And I was walking around like in this Viking costume that I bought off the internet, And I ended up running into the local reenactment group, which I didn't even know this was a thing. I didn't know Viking reenactment was a thing in the first place, which is funny because I bought the outfit. So you would figure like there's a reason that people had the outfits, right? And the rest was history. And I'm still with the same group 11 years later. And I started off really, like, some of my old photos, my kit was not great. And so slowly over the years, my group as a whole, because they started themselves at a Renaissance fair, and they've been around for over 20 years. And just in the past, like, since I've joined, we've gotten so much more focused on authenticity and education rather than just the combat, which is what a lot of groups do really, really well. But our true passion is talking to the public and educating about life in the Viking Age. So I do tablet weaving. I am a terrible spinner, but I do spin for a demo. At our last event, one of our guys was making mail, like Ooh, making the gosh. Rivets, like rivet by rivet. And there's a video I should find it on Instagram. I think it was just posted by the gentleman who took a Roman reenactor, took a videos of us at that event, which was really fun. But it's great. And like, you know, the public events are great because you get to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And the kind of private events are great too, because then you get to sit down with other Viking reenactors, some of whom are so knowledgeable and are so willing to share their knowledge. And it's really, every time I go to one of those, it just fills my cup. And what's really cool is that when I had written The Witch's Heart, I knew a lot about the myths and the sagas and all of that stuff, but I didn't know a lot about like material culture and daily life. So digging into the archaeological finds and stuff like that really helped me go back when I was revising The Witch's Heart for publication and kind of like throwing in more little like things to make the world feel more tangible and real.
So I guess it's a question I usually start with all my guests at the start, but we'll put it in now because it seems the right time for it. How did you first get into You mentioned it was in a class about mythology, wasn't it? So was that what first drew you into the kind of the whole big spiracle of Viking Norse stuff? Was it the mythology first and then the history?
So it was the language first, weirdly enough. In 2010, the autumn of 2010, I had the privilege of spending a semester in Uppsala, Sweden, going to school, studying abroad. And while I was there, I thought, might as well get a Scandinavian studies minor when I go back home, right? So the whole reason I chose to study in Sweden is because my grandfather is from Stockholm. So I was like, yeah, I have family and friends over there. So I had never left the United States before. So it was my first time abroad. And so I you know, checked the course catalog back at my university back here in the States. And there were like two classes offered in the Scandinavian department that semester. And one of them was Old Norse language. And after the first class, I was like, I am hooked. I forgot how weird this stuff is. Like, I'd read Norse mythology as a kid, but like never the Eddas, never the original sources. And here we were translating the story of Loki giving birth to a horse. And I was like, this is amazing. And that was really my gateway to it. So it was Old Norse. And then in the autumn, I took the mythology course, and then in the spring or the winter quarter, I took the Icelandic sagas as a course.
Wow.
All with the same professor, who's amazing. And it's her fault that I'm like this. And she knows it. Yeah, it was my gateway to all of this stuff really was through academia, but specifically through the Old Norse language.
But it's also interesting to learn that you do generally have family then, family connections back to Scandinavia as well.
Yeah,
on your mother's side or your father's side, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, it's on my mother's side. So my grandfather immigrated to the United States from Stockholm in the 50s. And he's since found out after I was even over there that he had like family that he didn't even know about. So I've gotten to know them. And I made some friends over there before I even went over through a Star Trek LiveJournal community. I met two of my best friends in Sweden through a Star Trek LiveJournal community. So yeah, and I speak the language a little bit, but everyone over there is so good at English that I rarely get a chance to use it, unfortunately.
because I know, I think I'm pretty sure it was you. When I was going to Norway for my debut in the symposium last year,
yes.
I discovered that you were going to be nearly around the same time.
Yes.
I was staying over, but it was those cats that they needed you back home.
Yes, it was the cats.
I let you go back to your cats.
Yes, and also, I'm also really glad that that didn't work out, honestly, because in my last few days in Norway, I did get COVID, and I was very, very ill. My last few days, and I'm glad that I didn't, you know, get you sick, get anybody else sick. So it was fortunate. But we'll have to meet again some other time.
We will. I keep getting emails from P&O Cruises, which is one of the main cruise lines around the UK, saying, "Oh, come on this Norwegian Fjord cruise." I'm like, I can't afford £899. That's not even for the excursions or the food or anything else. I just want to win the lottery, but then I don't play the lottery, so that's never going to happen either.
I understand. I'm right there with you.
Oh, so do you go to reenactments more or less around your local area where you live, or is it, do you travel a bit further afield for them? Have you ever been to Viking festivals in Scandinavia or Norway like that?
Not as a Viking. I've been to the Tunsberg Viking Festival, which is very cute. It's in Norway, just south of Oslo, on the western side of the fjord. And I do go to a bunch of festivals I live in the Midwestern United States, and so there's a bunch of little festivals happening all around here that I go to. I would love to go to more festivals in Europe, though. So one day, hopefully.
You need to come over and join me for the Jorvik Viking Festival.
Yes! The dream! Oh.
If I had a spare room, I would happily put you up. I just can't afford the flight cost.
I completely understand. Totally understandable.
Oh, well, one day. We will make it happen one day.
One day.
Because I am always there, often alone, because I'm an independent North person, because not many people in my immediate family or friends, even my mum's friends, kind of like know anything about this as a, even a subject. Like one of my mum friends asked me, like, who is Thor and how do we know about him? And I was like, that's two really big questions there. And we're going to need right. to TED talk. Just give me an hour.
Yes, yes. Oh my gosh. Like when I sat down to write the appendix for The Witch's Heart, I literally was sitting there and I was just like, who is Thor? How do I explain Thor from scratch? You know, like, ooh. So I get it.
But it just shows how kind of like, it's almost kind of like, almost as like a, to go Harry Potter-esque with a metaphor, for example, kind of like there's muggles and then there's wizards. There's people who know about this Norse stuff and the people who do not know about this Norse stuff.
Yep.
I mean, bless my mum. She's often been with me to the Orbit Viking Festival. She was the first person who went along through a lot to the finales. Then as I grew up, I just went on my own or made friends as they went. There was another podcaster from the America that used to come over a couple of years before COVID, but he's sadly we lost touch and his podcast seems to have halted, so I don't know what's quite happened to him, but he used to be a regular companion of mine. But I know this year I brought her out to the finale event just before her 70th birthday. It's even just as she's turning 70, she's still supporting me, even though
she's
really kind of like get into it as much as I do, but she appreciates the experience and being part of me and my geeky life, really.
It's great.
So you've got The Witch's Heart under your belt, you've got reenactment now in your life, fulfilling that circle. So then the next book came along, this beauty here, The Witcher, the Weaver and the Witch Queen. I always get the middle up, but it's The Weaver and the Witch Queen.
It sure is a title.
It's lovely. It's like they both have a w sound in them, and I really like the kind of like the asymmetry between the two books. And of course, the beautiful kind of like not almost Celtic, but not Celtic.
I love it.
Not
I love that cover. I love that cover so much.
Yes, they've both got really good covers. Really good covers. So, do you would like to tell our viewers and listeners about who features in The Weaver and the Witch Queen? Like, who's the Weaver? Who is the Witch Queen, and why?
So, The Weaver and the Witch Queen is a more fantastical reimagining of the origin story of Gunhild, Mother of Kings, who was a queen of Norway in the early 10th century, who, in a lot of the sources about her, is vilified due to doing villainous things. but she's so fun, and you know, on my like I think second reading of Eyjolfssaga, which is one of the more famous medieval Icelandic sagas, she is the arch nemesis of the main character Eyjolfsdóttir Hallgrímsson. So, and that I'm sorry, I just butchered that. So sorry. I can pronounce it in my head, but it doesn't always come out right.
I mean, I say it in a very anglicized way. You say it in a beautifully
Norse way. But yeah, she ends up being the lifelong antagonist of this like famous saga hero who's known for like how brutal he is. And so she's a heck of a girl, but I noticed in all her sources that she never like speaks with another woman really. Because women don't show up a lot in the sagas, and when they do, it's like, you know, these elite women with the really strong personalities most often, of which she is one of them. But I'm like, you know what? She needs two best friends. So I gave her two best friends.
And you tore them apart in quite dramatic style.
Yes, yes, I sure did. and while like part of me kind of wishes that I had just written Gunhild's story, I really at the time that I wrote it, I was really wanting to explore the lives of women who weren't elite, who didn't have this high status. So the other point of view character in the book, Audney, she's just a regular farm girl. Her family's poor, and after a raid, she and Gunhild are brought back together and kind of having to deal with the aftermath of everything that has happened. And their goal is to rescue their kind of third sister, Signy, who was captured during the raid and enslaved. So, it was the first book I ever wrote under contract, which means that I didn't have the book written first, like before it was picked up for publication. And let me tell you, it was really nice with The Witch's Heart having, you know, 7 years to kind of tinker with it versus being on that tight deadline. And knowing that people were going to read it, you know, I wasn't writing it just for me. I was writing it knowing that it was going to be published, and I got, you know, really in my head about it sometimes. But overall, I'm really proud of how it turned out. I don't think at the time I could have done any better than I did. So the book, it really means a lot to me.
It is superbly written, and you can really see how you've kind of like gone up another level with your storytelling from the witch.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That means so much to me. Thank you for saying that.
Well, it is. It's such an immersive world, and I really like how you've not just focused on Gunnhild as the queen as she is in all the sagas, but the life she had before she's the queen, like why she became the infamous queen of villainy, as I
put it. Yeah. And that's not even... Sorry, go on. Didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go on.
So, actually, I am working on a sequel that I don't know if it will be published by my publishers, but it's going to be published somehow. And then I really wanted it to be a trilogy. So she gets more villainous kind of as the third book really is going to be like her corruption arc, the way I have it planned. But you okay. see this, the seeds in The Weaver and the Witch Queen of like, you know, she doesn't always make the best decisions. And that's what I really enjoy about her. Like in the sources, you know, I wanted people who didn't know who she was to read The Weaver and the Witch Queen and say, well, I want to know more about her. And people who did know who she was to be like, you know, I can see her turning into the person she becomes in the sagas.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you've found that gap in the jigsaw and you've made a shape that fits it perfectly to create, to bridge the gap between what we know and what we don't know. And of course, you mentioned kind of like the other protagonists, Signy and Ogni, but there's also lots of other amazing, fascinating female characters in there, like the original Bulwer, the old witch that teaches Gunnhild her magical ways. Then you've got enemy witches, which is like, wow, witches versus witches, that was amazing.
Yes, thank you.
But then, of course, you explore the aspect of gender identity and fluidity as well. So you kind of like, you cover all the different aspects of being a woman, both as a woman and a woman wanting, a woman who feels deep down that she is someone else, not who she's born as, kind of thing. And I mean, I still quite like the character that was the tattooist, because of course you introduced the idea of tattoos, which I know you explained kind of like in, I think in your author notes, that kind of like historical evidence for it, because of course skin, not much skin is kept apart from the skin that's in a, I think it's Worcestershire Cathedral that's been pinned to a door from when they barricaded loads of Vikings in, but that's got no sign of tattoos on. But I just like that idea, because of course kind of like artistic stuff like that was probably not a man thing, it might have been a woman thing, but again, might have been, no one else can tell me otherwise, because yeah, no one really knows.
Like I really wanted to explore the different ways that women could have agency in the Viking age, apart from being a warrior, which is something we hear about all the time. And that's amazing. I think it's wonderful that women today are so empowered by this idea of field maidens, but that's not all women did in the Viking age. Like that's not the only way they could be powerful and could determine their own fates. And that was the whole reasoning behind writing the book in the first place, is to say, you know, shield maidens are great. But women deserve to have a choice, like in the ways that they live their lives, even, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. You've really touched on all bases, because there's a mother, well, not a mother, is there a stepmother figure? I can't remember if she's a stepmother, but there's a kind of like the woman that when Gunnhild goes with Eric, once she's met up with Eric,
Gyda.
She's kind of like, she's kind of like a very dominating figure in that household, and
I love her.
The very hardest to please type.
Yes.
Oh, yes. That's not quite the kind of like typical fairy tale villainous stepmother, but you can kind of get the same vibes and get that tricky relationship and dynamic going on.
Right.
So when you do get women who want to, obviously, get their independent selves in their own right and not have it given to them by men, then there is going to be that clash, because it's almost like a power of hierarchy, like who can be more higher up.
yes, exactly.
Oh, but yeah, it's full of wonderful characters, and I do encourage all readers and listeners to go buy it, download it, listen to it. Is it an audiobook as well?
It is, yes.
Right, yes, go get the audiobook as well.
And if anybody has listened to the audiobook for A Fate Inked in Blood by Danielle Jensen, which is also like a Norse adjacent sort of fantasy book, it's the same narrator, Nina Indis, and she is Norwegian. So she does a wonderful job.
I've got that book on my to-read list, and I haven't yet read it yet. I've got a holiday coming up, so hopefully I might get time to read it. She says, forgetting she's got a 4.5-year-old.
is she 4.5 already? Oh, my God.
4.5, going on 13 with Assassin's Creed. You know, this one.
Time flies. I remember, gosh, we've been mutuals on Twitter for a really long time. Yes. I literally remember, like, you announcing her birth. Man, I can't believe it's been so long.
Yep, she's got school coming up in September, so hopefully I'll get some reading time back. Thank you.
Excellent.
We shall see. Hopefully she'll settle in well. She's a firecracker in her own right. She really is. I mean, like, the attitude we give her sometimes comes back at us out of her mouth, and it's just hilarious. It's
hard. Yep. Oh my gosh.
But yes. They're two really wonderful books. And of course, I must obviously explore how you interpreted Eric Bloodaxe, yet to be named Bloodaxe, in this book. Because, of course, he is equally a part of Gunnhild's story. If there is they're very much two halves of the same whole. You can't have his story without Gunnhild, and you can't have Gunnhild without his story.
It's Eric and Gunnhild. Mm-hmm. My ride or die, my favorite historical couple. I am obsessed with them. Obsessed.
So would you like to give our reading listeners a kind of a brief recount of who Eric Bloodaxe is and why he's significant in Gunnhild's story?
Yes. So Eric Bloodaxe is the second king of Norway. He is the favorite son of Harald Fairhair, who is a legendary king who unified the country in the late 9th century. And Eric being named King Harald's successor ruffled a lot of feathers, because King Harald famously had many other sons with many other women. And upon his death, according to Snorri Sturluson's Heimskringla, which is the main source that I kind of used for this book, even though there are other Norwegian mainland sources that kind of talk about the formation of Norway and Eric Bloodaxe and all that stuff, I just think the Icelandic versions are like so much more, they read more like stories instead of histories, mm-hmm. right? Snorri does a really good job of like pulling you into the story. And yeah, a lot of it is probably BS, but like, he's a fan fiction writer and I'm writing fan fiction of his fan fiction. So like, that is what it is. So King Harald hands it over power to Eric circa 930. And then when he died circa 933, Eric and Gunnhild really only ruled for like 2 years before they were ousted by Eric's youngest brother, Halkan, who was fostered in England with King Athelstan. And then he comes and he ousts Eric and Gunnhild. And there's a couple different origin stories for Gunnhild. One was that she was a Danish princess, one of the daughters of King Gorm the Old of Denmark. And the other one was that she was a sorceress from Hålogaland, which is the story that I went with in The Weaver and the Witch Queen, because witches, right? So, and Snorri gives us this whole story about how they meet, and how, you know, Eric is doing, you know, his Viking raiding thing in the north of what is now like northwestern Russia. And then on his way back, there's a whole story there with the Sami, and it's kind of offensive, so I changed it. And that's how he meets Gunnhild up in Finnmark in northern Norway, and he brings her south with him and they get married. And a lot of the reason that she is vilified before she even does anything questionable is just because she had such a dominating personality. I mean, like, if your name is Eric Bloodaxe and you're telling your wife to pump the brakes on the murder, like, what is that telling you about this woman? Like, it's just amazing. Mm-hmm. So like, I, you know, one of the reasons that they were kind of vilified from the outset is that people didn't like Gunnhild. Like, they didn't like Eric because he was going around killing his brothers, but they also didn't like Gunnhild because she was such a force of nature. And again, this was before she even did anything bad. Mm. So, and that's kind of how their story starts. And then after fleeing Norway, they kind of bopped around the Orkneys and the British Isles, like, making trouble, until King Athelstan was finally like, can you guys stop? If I give you some lands in Northumbria, like, will you just stop? If you could take Jorvik, just stop with the raiding. And they were like, cool. So they ruled in Jorvik for a time until Eric was killed in battle in 954.
Yes, it was an ambush of some sort, I believe. So now, of course, he is famously the original logo, if not face, of the Jorvik Viking Centre when it first opened. And with it being their 40th anniversary, they've brought some retro looks back of kind of a bearded Viking, obviously without the horned helmet, thank you.
Yeah, and he also had a coin minted at York. Mm. So, mm-hmm. And I have many replicas of that coin. But yeah, so that's one of the many reasons I would like to go to the Jorvik Viking Festival one day. Just because like that has a special significance like in the story of Erik and Gunnhild. And there's a really, there's a really funny kind of like anecdote in Eyjolfssaga about what happens when Eyjolfskalde Grimsson meets Erik and Gunnhild in York. He's shipwrecked, he already has a feud with them, and there's just a whole like story that cracks me up that happens in York, in Jorvik. So yeah, that's my Erik Blood Axe spiel.
Praise poem to try and save his head.
Yes, and
if I remember, Gunnhild supposedly blamed as shapeshifting into a bird or something and to try and disturb him so he doesn't get a good sleep, so he can't write a good poem.
Yes, exactly. And my favorite part of, and that is why Gunnhild, her witch form in The Weaver and the Witch Queen is a swallow, which is also on the cover of the book.
Yes.
That's from that story, from that anecdote. And my favorite part of that, my absolute favorite part of that story is, you know, Arinbjorn, who has kinship ties to Eyjol. Arinbjorn, Eric's foster brother, who followed Eric and Gunnhild after they left Norway, he walks in, he's like, Eyjol, like, how's the poem going, buddy? And Eyjol's like, it would be going better if this stupid bird wasn't, like, yapping at the window all night and breaking my concentration. And Arinbjorn, like, chases the bird away and sits out there all night so it doesn't come back. And, like, that just cracks me up because, like, I picture Arinbjorn just, like, chasing her away with the broom and then just being like, don't come back. It just cracks me up. The sagas are so like unintentionally funny sometimes, or maybe it was intentional. I don't know. Sorry, I'm rambling, but I love that story.
No,
much.
It's absolutely all good. You know, I ramble a lot myself. So do not worry. As long as it's Viking stuff, I'm happy to just sit and listen. It's all good. But yeah, there is a wonderful, rich, as you say, and we've touched on it a lot, history behind these two characters. And again, it's nice to come across historical fiction that touches on these kings and queens and princesses and of course women of Scandinavia, because there's loads of course historical fiction written about them, many kings and queens of England.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a couple I know of that even touch on Queen Emma and Canute. They're my two favorite kind of like superhero celebrity historical king and queen, because they're both awesome. Equally as dynamic as Eric and Gunnhild, without the villainy, of course. But yes, they were amazing. So it's nice to actually touch on the origins of how Norway grew into now. Because, of course, so many people forget that Scandinavia was as fractured as Anglo-Saxon England was. There were so many feuding kings and queens and kings and princes and tribes and clans and whatnot. Because I do remember, I think, the first time I came across Gunnhild and Eric in fiction was certainly with Eric Schumacher's Hakon the Good trilogy, which explored a whole, well, it was a trilogy about Hakon the Good growing up.
Oh. And,
yeah.
I'm not familiar with that. That's awesome.
Yeah. He's also done a trilogy about Olaf Tryggvason as well, or who would become eventually Saint Olaf.
Oh.
There's a lot of Olafs in Norse history. It's confusing at times.
Yes.
But yes, but the Hakon the Good trilogy was good, especially because
fantastic.
Of course he grew up as a Christian and he's came back to a country that's predominantly pagan.
Mm-hmm.
And because I remember reading about him briefly in non-fiction stuff and hearing about how kind of like how he upset a lot of the Jarls and the Gothi at the time because he wouldn't let them eat horse meat at certain festivals because of course it was
religious.
He really explores the dynamic and the challenges both kind of like on the surface and below the surface between not just Hakon and Eric rumbling around each other trying to keep hold of the same crown, but also that clash of religions and society and trying to keep peace when everyone's got different opinions and things. So yes, I would recommend that series if anyone's interested.
That's awesome. I have to ask, and I know this is going to be spoilery, so I'm sorry.
No worries.
But does the trilogy end with Hakon getting, you know, hit with an arrow?
It does, yes.
Oh, ouch. And for the record, that was
it one does end with his death, because he does die from an injury from a battle.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think it's to do spear, with sorry. Someone he wronged. Oh, and in this case, it's an arrow injury, I think. And it festers, like, and then that's what kills him. Or at least I think that's what I read. It's been a while since I've read it.
That tracks. I mentioned this because one of the villainous deeds attributed to Gunnhild is magically guiding that weapon to hit Hakon on the battlefield, because the people that he's battling during the battle where he is injured or dies during his final battle are Gunnhild's sons, who have allied with the Danes and are trying to take back over Norway. And so after Hakon dies, Eric and Gunnhild's son, Harald Greycloak, becomes the king of Norway. So that's, oh man, I want to read this trilogy now. Oh, this is going on my TBR.
Oh, I'm pleased I can even help with it, because quite often I don't have many people to talk to about all the many, many, many books I read.
Yeah.
I kind of read them, I blog them, and then I kind of wait until I come across another fan, basically. But yes, there's lots. Lots indeed. I think I've got my review somewhere. I'll ping them to you in an email. But yes, definitely go look it up. So I guess we've obviously, and there's just the hope that maybe this will become a trilogy of books. If you could write about any other Norse figure, historical or mythological, who do you think it would be?
I have a whole host of story ideas that are just like percolating. And I don't know, I can't really answer that definitively. I will say that I did write an entire companion novel to The Witch's Heart that is about Sigyn, Loki's wife in Asgard. I don't know if that will ever see the light of day, but that is something that exists. And you know, I'm a third of the way into the sequel of The Weaver and the Witch Queen, and I don't know, like, I have so many things like already going on, I couldn't like say for sure like who I would want to write about next, just because there's so many things already in the works and I don't know which one of them is gonna stick, kind of. Which is new for me. I'm used to working on just one project at a time and being like super obsessed with that project. So the fact that I have so many things that I kind of started, I'm just trying to wait to get obsessed with something, I guess.
So are there any other books or authors that you might recommend to read some viewers listening if they want to learn more about these characters from history, Gunnhild and of course Eric? Or even Angrid Boda and Gulveig Hayden, that kind of jazz.
I can't really think of any besides like the original sources. Like the Eddas, Kevin Crossley Holland's retelling is really good. It's very thorough, which I like about it. I used to recommend Gaiman's retelling. I no longer do that, but it is short and sweet. And you know, has an appropriate amount of nuance. It was a fun little read. But I do like Kevin Crossley Holland's version is chunkier. It goes into a little bit more detail. I really like it. Yeah, I'm just a sucker for that original, like, you know, poetry and prose, that Snorri and the other anonymous authors give us, even though it can be really hard to tackle on your own. Like, if you have no familiarity with, like, medieval sources and medieval poetry, it can be a tough read. So I'm, like, grateful to people like you who are, like, making these podcasts and making content that's, you know, meant to educate people about this kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Well, I try, mainly by having guests like you on, because I don't know much myself. I just know what I read, and I quite often can't remember everything that I read, so I can just point people to books. Say, I read that one, and go read this one. But,
yeah,
that's brilliant to hear. That was what I was going to say. I think there is, I'm pretty sure I've read this somewhere, there is meant to be a TV series meant to be being in production somewhere in the world about Eric Bloodaxe. So it remains to be seen how they portray Gunnhild and that relationship and dynamic and enlighten her story the way you have, or whether they stick with the current conception of her as a villainous queen.
I'm excited/nervous to see what becomes of that show. Just because I enjoyed, it's, you know, by the same guy who made Vikings, History Channel's Vikings. And I did enjoy what I saw of that. You know, they play around with history a lot, and you know, it kind of is what it is. And that show got so many people into this stuff, and like that cannot be discounted. I think it's really important. That show has been really important. But I did not watch Vikings Valhalla because I object to Freydis Eric's daughter as a shield maiden warrior woman. Like she's cool enough in the saga as she is. And it just like bums me out that it just goes to, you know, I have to be very careful about how I talk about this because my words have been twisted before. Again, being a shield maiden is not the only way to have power. So the fact that like they made her shield maiden instead of like kind of giving her the nuance that the Vinland sagas do, kind of bummed me out. So I do worry about what they're going to do with Gunnhild, but I am excited to see the show. How could I not watch the show, right? Like,
I know if it's something I often find when I do speak, especially to kind of like academics or people who've done the research and like yourself, they know the sagas, they know the language, they know as much as we can know about what should or did happen. They'll either watch with bated breath and grinding teeth, or they'll watch 5 minutes and can't stomach anymore because it irks them too much. Obviously, me coming from kind of outside of that sphere, I can have the fourth wall of disbelief. I can forgive and forget because I see the interpretation more than the accuracy or the authenticity. Because nothing's going to be entirely authentic because it's so far removed from our past, time and culture and presence of mind and ability and our lifestyle and everything else.
Right.
I mean, gosh knows, if Vikings were around today and they saw us all getting into cars, they would think we'd all be eaten by mechanical things,
right?
Call them Jotun or something, because it's just so alien. Because it's just such a big, vast time,
and yes,
it's strange how we're always wanting to go. Humanity as a whole is always wanting to go back to a time before, a time that is so far removed,
right?
Time, like even the Victorians did it with kind of like, of course, Wagner's Great Opera. Most of all, even though that was classical mythology, it was a time. Kind of reflecting the changes of the time coming around then, but it's just really interesting how, because like as Britons, we're always wanting to go back to the Anglo-Saxon era, kind of like every fantasy game is kind of like an Anglo-Saxon-esque period. I won't get into Viking games, that's the whole of the podcast episode.
I've already done
awesome. And there's so many people I could talk to about it. But yeah, it's interesting. So of course I will keep an eye on it, and if I hear any more rumors about when it's coming out and what channels, because America probably will get it first, so I will let you know. Hopefully it'll be on Netflix and not on a Sky channel, which I don't have Sky.
Or I do believe Amazon is making it.
I might have to buy a free month or something. That's what my sister does a lot. She just kind of like gives her many an email address and gets a free month.
I'm, you know, when the show airs, I'm gonna go into it with an open mind because I can compartmentalize things. You know, people ask me a lot, like, what do you think of Marvel's Thor and Loki are like so inaccurate. I'm like, Marvel's Thor and Loki are not trying to be mythology Thor and mythology Loki. Therefore, they are fine. They are a separate thing. Like, and I can enjoy that. I can watch it without my Norse mythology brain being on. And so I'm hoping for the same thing. And I'll probably go back and watch Vikings Valhalla one day too. I'll be honest. I don't like being a hater. I like liking things. You know? Like I that's not the energy that I wanna bring to the vibe. That's not the vibe I want to bring to the function, being a hater, you know. So
well, if you ever do get into watching Vikings Valhalla, I've also done a review panel series of that as well.
Oh really? Okay, cool.
Yes, I did it with some wonderful historical authors called Patricia Bracewell and Helen Hollick. Hello, pussycat.
Sorry about him.
It's all right, it's fine. Cats are cats. Because they've written historical fiction about Emma, Queen Emma, and King Canute. We also had Sharon Bennett Connolly, who's a wonderful British historian who really ups and promotes women figures throughout history. She's done a wonderful book on Scottish queens. She's done about women and the anarchy of women, kind of like the different feudal queens that we've had in our British history.
Fantastic. And
I think she's got another book coming out soon about kind of like it, it's a really long title, but it's a spin on kind of like the good, bad, mad, and not good to know. But she's kind of expanded it to kind of like, you know, not mad, not bad, but just defiant kind of thing. Something along those lines. She's got that in the pipeline, but she's a really good one to look at if you want to know about more powerful, amazing women in history, many British, of course.
Awesome.
Because she knows everything there is to know about Emma and, of course, King Canute's travels and that kind of thing. And then in the later two series, we have Justin Hill, who wrote a lot about Harold Hardrada in historical fiction.
Okay.
In his amazing book, Viking Spire, because Harold Hardrada is another epic hero of mine. Because his life before he became Harold Hardrada is absolutely amazing.
Yes. I have his saga sitting on my TBR, like, right over there. So, yeah.
But yeah, he was just such a guy before he became the guy that we all know him to be. And thankfully, the series does touch on that aspect of his life, although they do, of course, have lots of dramatic licenses. And there is a lot of time Doctor Who wizardry going on. Because, of course, Queen Emma wasn't around when Harold Hardrada was around. One of them was really old. One of them was a baby, historically, or the other way around. No, yeah, Queen Emma was really old. Hardrada was very young because they were the prime of their life in the series, and that just doesn't add up logically.
So, wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yes, but it's they wanted to somehow touch on all these great figures in one era instead of two.
I mean,
we say this a lot in the panel. They could have done a series on each of the figures and then made a huge omnibus edition more than try and compact it all.
That's exactly what Vikings does, though. Like, you know, it starts at Lindisfarne, 793, and then before you know it, a few years later, they're raiding Paris, which doesn't happen until, like, the mid-800s. So Ragnar would have been, like, 100 when he raided Paris, but they just kind of condensed everything for the sake of storytelling, and I cannot fault them for that. They're just wanting to tell a good story. I get that. History, if there's one thing that I've learned in all of my research for Weaver, it's that history is not always a good story. Sometimes it kind of sucks.
Yep.
And it's
loads of boring parts where there's peace. Yeah. Like little Canute's reign was peaceful.
Yep.
He had no great big battles. Once he became king, that was it. He didn't, apart from sourcing out some problems, I think it was in Norway where his brother ruled for a time before he died. He had to sort out that. So Emma ruled in his stead. But I mean, they went off to meet the Pope in Constantinople. So, not Constantinople, wrong. The Roman Emperor. Rome, even. Not Constantinople, Rome. Further afield, Rebecca, get your geography straight. Sorry.
But there's a lot of boring bits, and there's a lot of bits that are just really unsatisfying, too. That's like, how do I spin this into like a satisfying ending for the readers of this book when in history it's not satisfying at all?
Very good points. It's been amazing talking to you, Genevieve, about everything and everything. I'm glad we've been kind of like remote social friends all this time because we do connect on so many levels.
Yes.
Your books, absolutely love them.
Thank you so much.
I hold them, I devoured them, and they're gorgeous covers. And I, of course, wish you best of luck in any writing projects coming up, whether it's the same characters or new ones. And I look forward to seeing what you get up to next.
Thank you so much.
Let me know.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Dear viewers and listeners, please do subscribe to the channel. Next month's episode will feature another amazing author, Caitlin Felix. She's got her debut novel out, Rand's Daughters. Have you read it yet?
Yes, I beta read it. Oh, Katie's been one of my internet friends for a long time. So it's wonderful to see her release this book at last. I'm still working on rereading the final edition that just was released, but it is so much fun. I really loved it.
I can't remember what I put in my review, but there was so much I could put in my review because it was just like a huge spiel of love and affection and admiration and respect for how she did it.
Absolutely.
I think she shows that you don't have to have a male hero like Bernard Cornwell's Uhtred to have a historical adventure. You can have it as a woman and it can still be an historical adventure novel.
Absolutely.
But yes, she's coming up as episode 17.
Hooray! She'll be coming
out in August. I can't wait to talk to her about it because I know she did send me the, I think it was the final the advanced reader's copy version, and I devoured it like in 3 days,
mm-hmm.
or 3 nights, I should say, because I just couldn't put it down. It was just
wonderful.
Awesome. So yeah, so please do stay in touch, dear viewers and listeners on YouTube and Spotify, wherever you're listening and watching today, and we shall see you all in Valhalla again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussions between my special guests and myself. Please do check out the episode blurb for links to their works and websites. If you liked this episode, let me know by giving it a thumbs up. Let me know if you learned something new in the comments. And of course, click subscribe to Valhalla Conversations wherever you are listening or watching. This podcast can be watched on YouTube and YouTube Music, and it can also be listened to on Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, and on RSS.com. We hope you can join us in Valhalla again soon for more conversations.